Good afternoon. It's a Juno afternoon. I'm Andy Klein, your host for today on this beautiful, sunny afternoon here. But snow is coming tonight, so get ready for that. Supposed to be here by 3 a.m. Got a good show for you today. We're going to be talking all about the new upcoming season happening at Perseverance Theater. Get the deets on that. Also be talking to Eileen Hosey from Catholic Community Services. Going to be here talking about Tai Chi. And Bob Armstrong will be here to offer a preview of Friday night's Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center lecture about coping with weather. That's all ahead, plus National Native News coming up right now.
This is National Native News. I'm Art Hughes in for Antonio Gonzalez. Armed law enforcement officials moved into the former Ocheti Chikoi camp Thursday, clearing teepees, tents, and other structures of any remaining people. Crews used heavy construction equipment to raise any buildings that remained and clean up debris. Law enforcement officials say they arrested at least 33 people. That's on top of the 10 arrests Wednesday at the start of the operation to clear the camp. Joy Braun with the Indigenous Environmental Network says closing the camp is a setback, but she says it created a movement of awareness against other threats.
The roots are taking place elsewhere around the world, and you see that in the Sable Trail pipeline down at Big Bend, the pipeline down in Texas, there's two of them, Diamond Pipeline. You see it everywhere. People are growing an awareness.
The Standing Rock Sioux Tribe says comments by the White House about contact with tribal officials is false. The tribe's statements follow comments made during the daily White House briefing by spokesman Sean Spicer. He was asked whether President Donald Trump had been briefed on the situation at Standing Rock and whether he was worried opposition to the Dakota Access Pipeline might delay the project. Spicer's wording made it seem as if federal officials were in frequent contact with tribal officials.
Our team has been involved with both the tribe and the governor there, and so we are not only we're constantly in touch with them, and I think we feel very confident that we will move forward to get the pipeline moving, and so we'll have a further update on that, but I think we're in constant contact with the officials there.
In a written statement, Standing Rock Sioux Chairman David Archambault II said the statement is absolutely false. He relayed the fact that he was on his way to meet with Trump administration officials last month when he learned of the president's order to expedite the pipeline project and cancel the environmental review that was holding up a critical easement on federal land. He calls the timing of the executive action insulting to him and the tribe. The Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe has joined Standing Rock's request for a judge to halt the pipeline project. The tribes are asking for a summary judgment against Energy Transfer Partners, the company building the pipeline. The legal motion asked the judge to revoke permission for the easement to install the pipeline under Lake Oahe, a part of the Missouri River, because the Army Corps of Engineers violated federal rules when it canceled a rigorous environmental review. Just a little over 2 months ago, the agency said the review was needed. Meanwhile, the company says oil could be flowing through the 1,100-mile pipeline in as little as 2 weeks. Tribal officials and their lawyers say they're surprised by the company's announcement, since earlier estimates indicated the pipeline would not be in use until May. The tribes will appear in federal court in Washington, D.C. on Tuesday. A legislative panel rejected an effort to limit tribal casino gambling in Idaho. The Spokane Spokesman Review reports a measure to change the state's 15-year-old law allowing tribal gaming failed by one vote Thursday in a House committee. The measure was supported by gambling organizations that run a dog racing venue in Coeur d'Alene. Gambling opponents also spoke in favor of the proposal. The amendment would have limited the types of machines casinos offer. Officials from the Coeur d'Alene tribe and the Fort Hall Business Council of the Shoshone-Bannock tribes were among those speaking against the amendment. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is returning human remains of at least 109 Aleutic people more than 50 years after they were taken from a Russian Orthodox cemetery on Chirikov Island in Alaska. It's a step toward repatriating the remains to the Aleutic community. Alaska Native News reports anthropologists removed most of the remains in 1962 from the cemetery threatened by coastal erosion. The remains were housed at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee and Indiana University at Bloomington for research. They now go to the Aleutic Museum until a formal repatriation process. With National Native News, I'm Art Hughes.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation. with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation.
Support by the Albuquerque Hispano Chamber of Commerce's Convention and Tourism Department, providing complete convention and visitors planning services to Native American conventions. Information on convention and tourism services at siabq.org.
And by the law firm of Sanosky Chambers, Saxe, Miller & Munson, advocating Native American interests throughout the United States, with offices in New Mexico, California, Alaska, and Washington, D.C. Native Voice One, the Native American radio service.
There's something new in the air. It's a little soul, it's a little jazz, and it's a little bit more. And hey, this is Nod here, and I'm here every Friday night from 9 to 11. Won't you join me for Far True Radio, and I promise you, you'll be glad you did. Friday nights at 9 p.m., KRNN-FM.
And welcome back to A Juno Afternoon. I'm your host, Andy Klein, for this Friday, where snow is supposed to be coming in by about 3 a.m., and then rain and snow, and for tomorrow, a chance of rain and snow before 9 a.m., and then just cloudy through mid-morning. And joining me now from Perseverance Theater is Art Roach and Amy O'Neill Hoke. Thanks so much to both of you for coming in.
Thanks for having us.
And let's talk the 2017 season. We still got some left from the 2016-17 season, right? To Kill a Mockingbird is coming up, right?
That's right. Opening
March 17th.
Oh,
March 17th. It's
the preview. Yeah. St. Patty's Day opening. That's good, yeah. Mm-hmm. So tell me a little bit about that. Is that already underway and in rehearsals and production and designing and stuff like that?
Yeah, Art's directing.
Big time. Yeah, we've been 2 weeks into rehearsal. We're not. I can't remember. Second or third. We've been rehearsing for a while.
Okay.
Yeah. Been through the whole play, starting over, going through it again. Yeah.
Great. So who are some of the principals, both behind the scenes and actors?
Yeah. The creative team includes Christopher Metzger, who designed Othello last year. So he's come back. Terrific young designer. And lighting designer's new to us. She's an old friend from grad school, Lucrecia Briseño. She's just really brilliant and exciting to have her. And Lucy Peckham, one of our old standbys, is doing the sound.
Cool.
And then on stage, Enrique Bravo is playing Atticus Finch. And there's three, I think, really fantastic young actors playing Scout, Jem, and Dill, the three kids in the show. So Scout is Seth Copens, Dill is Theo Hauck, and Jem, is Forrest Davis. So really terrific young actors who we're having a lot of fun with.
Yeah, so that's an interesting thing to cast young. I mean, especially Scout, I guess, of all the cast, that's got to be such a crucial.
Yeah. That character really kind of carries a lot of the story.
Right.
I think these actors are so serious about it. They're so talented and they're so committed to doing great work. And they're just a lot of fun to work with.
Yeah,
so we're just having a good time. And then the older actors in the cast are just trying to keep up, to be honest with you.
Right.
Don't want to be showed up by Scout, really.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Or made fun of by Dill. You know?
So first pay as you can is the 14th, and then it opens up on the 17th and runs for 3 weeks?
4 weekends.
Four weekends? Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, cool. All right, so that's To Kill a Mockingbird, and that's the last one of the season?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then tell me about what's coming up for next season. You've got the full lineup all set, and
yeah, and
let's go through them.
Available.
Yeah.
There's six plays. I'll start. We're opening with a comedy called The Elaborate Entrance of Chad Deity. So it's a play about wrestling. And you probably know this, but those wrestling matches and those pro leagues that are televised, they're all scripted, right? They know who's going to win.
Sports entertainment,
right,
as they call it.
Sports and entertainment. And this is about, so if they're scripted and someone has to win, that means someone is scripted to lose. And the writer said, well, what would that be like? What would that guy be like? And the play is about a wrestler, a Puerto Rican man who wrestles under the name of Mace. And he's just a little sick of the losing. So he just, all he asked for, it's a small thing, is he just asked for a day off. And he says, I'll get a substitute. I know a guy. He has a friend he played basketball with. And he convinces his bosses, just let my pal fill in for me, and I'll take a break from this match, and Chad Daigh can beat him. Chad Daigh is the name of the champ. And that all sounds good. And the play begins after that's been set up, and his pal, Mace's pal, beats Chad Daigh. And when his pal is asked about it, he said, well, Chad's not a very good wrestler.
He actually started really wrestling.
Yeah, I was like, well, it's hard to lose to him.
Yeah,
right. Not very good. So the play then sort of goes into how do you repair the champ's reputation, and the guy goes off script again, and by Act Two, poor Mace is just saying, where is there an honest moment in my career as an athlete? Which is not a good question to ask in this world.
If you're a professional wrestler, yeah.
It's pretty fun.
Yeah, it's more about the entertainment
and
part.
It's funny,
yeah. I'm a huge, I'll just reveal right now, I'm a huge vintage professional wrestler fan. I grew up in Florida watching Florida Championship Wrestling and then watching Georgia Championship Wrestling and then World Championship Wrestling and then WWF bought World Championship. I mean, I know the whole history of it. I kind of lost touch with it in the 90s and 2000s, right? And that's when it really kind of became this gigantically huge profitable thing, but... But it's really the idea of these guys. There are definitely these guys, when you follow it, that when he comes in, you know, well, that guy loses.
Yeah, I don't know
and
who that guy is.
And this guy wins, right? I'd have never heard of that guy.
He's going to lose, yeah.
Or even there's guys who, like this character, there's guys who you do know, and you know them, and they always lose.
Right.
And there
right.
can even be crowd favorites, and yeah. they lose. Because
poor losing, yeah.
Yeah, a heel is the champ, and so the heel gets to win all the time, all that stuff. Yeah,
right. And I think Chris Diaz, the playwright, you know, he entered this world with that same affection for it, you know, mm-hmm. That's really apparent, and it's real. There's real wrestling happening on stage. It's going to be a lot of
that's
fun.
That's going to be an amazing part of it. The choreography of it, it's going to be.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Chris has a file of links that he sent me that are like, these are the moves. So you can see what it looks like. How do you stage this? And he said, oh, well, you stage it. And
you just get in it.
His other piece of advice. The play's been done about 30 times, not as much as a play this good has been, and maybe it's because of the staging, but he said, here's what's going to happen, Chris, the playwright did. You're going to get a fights guy. We have a fights guy. And the fights guy is going to then say, I need a wrestling guy. And they'll work together, and that's cool. And the actors will then say, we haven't gotten to this point, but he said, what will happen is the actor will say, how do you do this without getting kicked in the face? And the wrestler will say, you just get kicked in the face. And the fights guy will say, okay, we do this many shows a week. They're in this union. You can't kick them in the face. Oh, and then you have to figure out how to do that on stage. But so far, that's exactly what's happened. Chris has been right on about it.
Because just because it's scripted doesn't mean these guys aren't tough. I mean, these wrestlers are tough guys,
but
Okay, so that's, wow, that sounds like a great start. Amy, what's the second one coming up
then? Well, next is a world premiere by our local playwright, Joel Bennett. We're really excited about this. It's called Dreaming Glacier Bay. And
so Joel Bennett, cinematographer,
mm-hmm. yep.
wrote a play.
Yeah.
That's really exciting.
Yeah,
pretty exciting.
Because he's such an extremely talented filmmaker.
Absolutely.
But he usually works in the documentary realm, nature documentary, those things. That's what I know him working in.
Right.
So for him to get into writing
a place and a story from that place and a true story that has quite a bit of mystery to it. So that's kind of what's really fun about it.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Well, that's exciting. So what's it called again?
It's called Dreaming Glacier Bay, and it's set in the 30s, and it's about a friendship between John Barrymore when he was at his most famous, perhaps not at his most productive because he was probably drinking a lot of
his
time, but certainly at his most famous in the 1930s. And he had an old friend named Muzz Ibach, and the Ibachs, Muzz and Joe, had a fox farm on Lemmershire Island near Glacier Bay. And in the 30s, Barrymore would motor up in his big boat, the Infanta, with Dolores, the wife of the decade, and visit with them. And it turns out that Muzz and Barrymore probably knew each other in New York City when he was a stage actor and she was a dancer. No one knows beyond that the nature of their life. Joe, believe me, Joel mm-hmm. has done all the research that he can try and get to the truth of their past, but it's not written down. They didn't leave us a record. So there's a mystery there. And I think the best way to describe the play is that any long, long friendship like that, there's something that's only between the two of those people that only they can know. And the play explores that nature of friendship, that there's a mystery that belongs to those two people.
Wow, that's exciting to hear that this new playwright, in a way,
mm-hmm.
who's this exceptionally longstanding respected talent in Juneau. That's really cool.
Yeah.
Okay. What's up after that one? What do these generally run? That runs in October-ish, is that right? Yeah.
So, yeah, Dreaming Glacier Bay is late October into November.
Okay. Then yeah. What's next?
The month of December we'll be running Steel Magnolias.
Oh, I get to work on that one.
Yay.
Andy's working on that one, right?
I'm so excited about working on that one. Yeah. I get to do the sound on that.
Great comedy, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, we need to create, there's a plot line in there where one of the older ladies that goes to this beauty parlor buys the local radio station. She doesn't like it, so she buys it. So you hear it before she buys it, you hear it after she buys it. When you're like a 70s pop station in Louisiana.
I'm your man.
With two different times.
I can do that.
Pretty exciting.
We need you.
That's really fun. And then Steel Magnolias, I think most people probably have heard that story, but it takes place in one day. Is that right, kind of? Or just a very short period of time?
Several days.
Yeah.
Kind of over a summer.
Yeah.
And it's six friends, including Truvy, who owns the beauty salon, all women.
Yeah.
And they go through all kinds of different things. There's some weddings.
Now, how far out ahead do you have in your mind people that you know are leads or casting or things like that for these? Or is everything up for grabs still for the future season? I mean, do you design certain plays around, okay, I know
sometimes
Shona's going to be in this one, or I know someone's going to be in this one, or... You know, we're gonna make sure James is, oh, he'll be perfect. And, you know, does that kind of happen?
A little bit of both. The directors for these are all set. So Shona, for example, is directing the wrestling play.
Okay.
She's really pumped about it. It has a lot of ideas that she likes.
Great.
And that one in particular will feature Enrique Bravo in a role as a Latino character. And
yes.
Of course, he's Mexican-American.
Yes.
So that'll be really fun. And I remember he
was good in a unitard, too.
He does love the fight choreography. So. I think he needs to add a little padding front and back for these moves. These moves are based on muscled-up dudes.
So that's true.
Don't be so lean, Enrique. But anyway, so that one was definitely like, oh, interesting, we have that actor. There's some others that
would
be a little harder to find. And Shona was a good project for Shona that she can really sink her teeth into is always good. And then Dreaming Glacier Bay, there's a director we've been working with in Anchorage creating our Christmas Carol, and I had known him for a long time, but he directs a Christmas Carol for Cincinnati Playhouse and has done so every year for nearly 30 years, and he still likes the play. Like, he's not sick of it at all. He could still talk about the play, and he's a good new plays guy as well. So he met Joel and really got a lot. They just really had a good relationship.
Good.
So Michael will be working here, and he's
thrilled. Is there a specific challenge to that play? You know, the wrestling, obviously, and the choreography, is that mm-hmm. that's going to be a unique challenge. Is there a unique challenge to the Glacier Bay one?
I think bringing John Barrymore to life, famous actor.
Sure.
And Michael is a very, very good actor, and he had some great ideas about what to think about when casting an actor who has to play Barrymore.
Right.
So we're contacting people who've played 19th century characters. Like, for example, there's a guy that made a career out of a solo show playing Edwin Booth, the famous 19th century actor that John Wilkes Booth was related to.
Oh, okay, yeah.
And that then means that if this guy were to do it, he has within him already a lot of experience with that 19th century acting side.
Thing, though, because you want to have him play that, but he can't come off as overly stiff. He needs to be a real character that you can relate to as an audience still. So,
that one really has, I think, an acting challenge. And then Joel and Michael just had a really
good
time on their workshop of it, so that seemed good.
Okay, and then Steel Magnolias, and then what's after that?
We have a world premiere. You want to talk about this one?
Oh, sure. Yeah. Well, this is a new play, another by an Alaskan playwright, an Alaskan Native playwright named Lucas Rowley.
Which, by the way, let's just talk for a minute about, they don't talk back. I mean, the rousing success.
It's
still, right?
You
guys still must be buzzing about it.
Yeah, I'm pretty excited.
It's just so cool, and Frank's work is wonderful as it is, and then to see it come to fruition, and as he was saying, kind of like nervous about having it play in his hometown, and then, of course, it's got, you know, I heard the whole last weekend was a complete sellout and everything. Yeah, so exciting. Anyway, okay, so another local playwright. Tell me about this.
Yeah, so Lucas is from Anchorage. And this play is, it's a guy, he's really got a high-stress job and some, you know, challenges at home, and he imagines himself in Alaska Native Corporation to kind of run his life. And as the play progresses, it gets more and more interesting because his board members and shareholders take more and more control of what's going on.
Wow. Okay. Very interesting.
Do you want to add something to that?
He incorporates himself, like kind of like the inside of your brain becomes an Angsa Corporation. So by intermission, he's had board members calling his wife at home and saying, you know, William's really, you really ought to lighten up on him. Or he's had board members going and meeting his clients and board members talking to his boss and board members inviting him to the bar, and he's a recovering alcoholic, so that's not so good. And you just think this couldn't get any worse, and he's going to have to do something at intermission. And when you come back, it actually does get worse.
It gets worse. Yeah. So it's played as a comedy.
Yeah.
But also that's a really interesting concept, you mm-hmm. know, as you bring it up to a higher level of the control native corporations
Absolutely.
Have over tradition and over. Yeah. So that's pretty. Oh, that's cool.
And
yeah,
Lucas
cool.
is clever, and it's written very.
It's a very funny, clever play, but what I think William discovers is that the problems he's trying to deal with, he really should think about his family or his culture or his community or his friend, those rather than a corporation to solve
right.
them, that there are good things that corporations can do, but that's not the only resource. And that's,
right.
that's a simple message. And the way he resolves it is hilarious. It's a very clever thing.
Okay, and after that one, so that's the fourth play. What about mm-hmm. the fifth and sixth plays of the season? Tell me about the fifth one.
The classic is that's the fifth one. So same time as we're doing Mockingbird in 2018, and it's Cyrano de Bergerac. And this version of Cyrano was commissioned about 10 years ago by the Roundabout, and a friend of a friend is the writer. Know him through Peter Dubois, actually. David Grimm is the writer's name. Peter did a David Grimm play at the Public when I was in graduate school that I saw. And the commission, the idea of the commission was to see if you could capture some more of the French original in English, which is really challenging. It's been a hard play to translate. We have good translations, but not what
so there's a thought out there that there's been a lot lost in the translation of this play. Clever French phrasing.
Some of it's
and
Frenchness.
Yeah, right.
Some of it's panache. It's a little hard to translate.
Right, right.
So David's approach is to see if he can ground the idea of the heightened language, the poetry that Cyrano is so good at. If you think about the balcony scene from Roxanne, mm-hmm. all that, in character, and that what he is a spoken word artist, as it were, not literally, but he's the kind of person who raises his language when he's trying to impress a girl or smack down a rival or simply make a point in a better way. He becomes more poetic.
Hmm.
And it's a really cool idea. So it's a very intentional shift. And the play is written in verse in those sections, and it becomes prose in other sections.
Okay,
and
then
it's really cool.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah.
Okay, and then so that's the classic.
Mm-hmm.
And then what's the last play? The rounding out the season for 2000.
It's
into 2018.
Yeah,
we're way ahead here. Yes,
yeah, way into the future. Yeah, this is a project that I really wanted to do. So it's the one that I'll direct next year. It's called The Arsonists. And it's by Jackie Goldfinger, and it's about a woman who is ready to start her career as an arsonist. She's learned the craft. She's really good at it. She's mastered it, and she does one last job with her father, who is the person that she's studied with or learned with or whatever, and it goes terribly, terribly wrong. So the play begins as they're kind of escaping from this arson job that went haywire, and she has to say goodbye to her father. She kind of They live in a shack somewhere in Florida, off the grid, and she brings this big bundle in and shoves it under the floorboards and starts packing and making fuses and singing songs, and her father appears, and they tell stories about growing up and burning down buildings, and by the end of the play, she torches the place, and you realize, oh, she's actually destroying the evidence. He's been a ghost the whole time. And that's the story.
Wow.
So there's terrific roots music in it, and it's a wonderful, wonderful portrait of a rocky start to your life as an adult.
It's an adult arsonist.
Yeah, arsonist.
Wow,
yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Well, Amy, I don't want to stop talking to you guys without getting a pitch in. For membership and making sure that people get tickets.
You just heard the whole season, and we have a new cool feature with subscribing this year we're calling Super Subscriber. So if you get the whole season, what that means is you can come back to the theater as many times as you want for free, space available. So you see a show, you loved it, you want to come back, you just call us, and if there's space, or you come with your little Super Subscriber card, and you come and you can get a ticket and you can sit down for free. So
that's really cool.
Pretty fun.
Yeah. just be able to go and watch it as many times as you want, as you say, space available. And,
yeah, and those are available right now. And then coming in March, we will have Flex subscriptions, which means if you want to pick and choose which shows that you're going to, you'll be able to do that.
Very cool. All right. Well, thanks so much to both of you for letting us know all about what's going on and coming up at the Perseverance Theater. Such a great resource that we have here in town, and thanks so much for all the work you guys do and letting us know what's going to be happening.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, thanks. Coming up next, we're going to hear from Garrison Keillor. This is Writer's Almanac.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Friday. It's the 24th of February, 2017. It's the birthday of Wilhelm Carl Grimm, born in Hanau, Germany, 1786, who, with Jakob, his older brother, brought out Grimm's Fairy Tales in 1812, the first collection of folklore in modern publishing history. It's the birthday of Weldon Keyes, born Beatrice, Nebraska, 1914, came out with a collection of poems in 1943, moved to New York City, became a film critic as well, took up painting, went to San Francisco, and one day in 1955, he packed a sleeping bag and his savings account book and simply disappeared. His car discovered abandoned on the Golden Gate Bridge, and to this day no one knows for certain whether he killed himself or went to Mexico. It's the birthday of the writer and teacher Mary Ellen Chase, born in Blue Hill, Maine, 1887, little seacoast village founded by her ancestors. She wrote A Goodly Heritage, Silas Crockett, windswept about the seafaring life of people living in rural Maine. And she taught at Smith College for almost 30 years. Sylvia Plath was a student of hers, as was Betty Friedan. It's the birthday of the novelist George Augustus Moore, born County Mayo, Ireland, 1852. Went to Paris to study art and become a painter, moved to London, wrote a novel which was banned by libraries for its sexually explicit passages, and then returned to Ireland, became a leader of the Irish literary revival. George Augustus Moore, who said, "A man travels the world in search of what he needs and returns home to find it." And it's the birthday of Jane Hirschfield, born New York City, 1953, who was a member of the first graduating class at Princeton to include women, studied Japanese and Chinese literature, moved to California in 1974, practiced Zen Buddhism full-time for 8 years. She said, "The ability to stay in the moment, to investigate it through my own body and mind, was what I most needed to learn at that point in my life, to stay within my own experience more fearlessly. You cannot write until you know how to inhabit your own experience." Here's a poem for today by Jane Hirschfield entitled Sweater. "What is asked of one is not what is asked of another. A sweater takes on the shape of its wearer. A coffee cup sits to the left or the right of the workspace, making its pale Saturn rings of now and before. Lucky the one who rises to sit at a table day after day, spilling coffee sweet with sugar, whitened with milk. Lucky the one who writes in a book of spiral-bound mornings, a future in ink, who writes, hand unshaking, warmed by thick wool. Lucky still, the one who writes later, shaking, acrobatic at last, the sweater, elastic as breath that enters what shape it is asked to. Patient the table, unjudging the ample, unfillable cup, irrefusable the shape the sweater is given, stretched in the shoulders, sleeves lengthened by unmetaphysical pullings on." A Pompa Jan Hirschfeld sweater from her collection Come Thief, published by Alfred A. Knopf and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, a monthly devoted to discovering and publishing new voices in poetry. More at poetryfoundation.org. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Do you like your country and rock, your folk and your blues, all in the same sound? Or do you like your music independent, honest, real, with blue-collar roots? Tune in to Southern Exposure Friday nights at 7 for a unique blend of Red Dirt, Americana, Outlaw, and more with me, your host, Red Stewart. At Southern Exposure Friday nights at 7 on KRNN FM Juno, music and arts from Alaska's capital.
And welcome back to a Juno Afternoon. Andy Klein with you. And Eileen Hosey has joined me from Southeast Senior Services. Eileen, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be here.
Yeah, we're listening to some appropriate music, I think, for what you're going to talk about. We're going to talk about Tai Chi for seniors.
That is correct. We have a new class of beginning Tai Chi starting next week. We got a grant from the State of Alaska Senior and Disability Services to provide Tai Chi for seniors. One of the most important benefits of Tai Chi is increased strength and balance. One of the leading causes of injuries in seniors is falls.
Yeah.
So if you can take a Tai Chi class, you'll improve your chances of staying healthy.
And Tai Chi, for those who aren't familiar with it, it's I've taken a few Tai Chi classes in my day, and it's such a wonderful exercise form because it can be done at so many different levels.
Exactly.
You know,
yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I just feel like you can right. This you could be an absolute beginner and never have done it before, and you'll go in and you can do these very fluid movements, and it's built off of a very specific set of movements, right?
That's right. And you start by learning 1, 2, 3, 4 movements, and each class builds incrementally on the previous classes. They're slow, they're fluid, they're easy, and before you know it, you're doing the entire set. We have a certified instructor, Glenn Ray, who's taught Tai Chi for many years and is a master at it.
And it can be a lifelong pursuit to master the movements from one to the other.
Yes.
And I think that the people who kind of do it as a lifelong pursuit, it's about this concept of moving chi, right? It's, you have this chi that is your energy or your inner energy,
yeah.
And that's sort of a concept that people
exactly.
are...
Yeah, exactly. I was in Hawaii recently, and I happened to walk by the beach where about 25 very elderly people were doing Tai Chi, and I stopped and watched the beautiful movement and the people and their faces, and so I was like, oh, this is a wonderful stress reducer, because you work from the core of your body, and you can't be stressed when you're going through the movement. So that's an added benefit. We need less stress in our life, too.
Yeah, and every movement has a really cool, fun name, you know, Tiger Salutes the Mountain or something. I don't know if that's right. Or, Crane Over the Water. Or, there's all those sort of really, and it's beautiful. It's very beautiful. It's about the beautiful form of the human body, but it's also about these movements and as you say, being meditative in a way that moves.
Yeah. Exactly.
It seems like, so tell me about, as you were mentioning, one of the key benefits of it, especially for seniors, is this idea of bringing balance and allowing you to kind of increase your physical balance.
Right. Well, the most recent statistics that we have from a fall prevention workshop I recently did showed that falls are the leading cause of death, accidental death, for people over the age of 65, and falls cause 90% of the hip fractures. So if you extrapolate from that, 40% of those people hospitalized for hip fracture do not return to independent living. And in my work at Southeast Senior Services, the most important aspect for everybody is to stay independent. And so if you can stay strong and if you can prevent falls and stay independent, your life is much better.
Yeah, stay injury-free as much as possible. Right. And so are there statistics around Tai Chi and balance increase or decrease falls or that kind of thing? Or is it more just the idea of working with balance, working with strength, working with moving the body?
Well, I'd have to say yes and no, because I don't know the statistics. But I would say if somebody successfully completed an 8-week class, which meets twice a week, you are bound to be stronger. You are bound to be your balance should be better and things should improve. And occasionally we have a level 2 class so you can continue on. And many people who complete the 8 weeks class continue to do it on their own because you know the movements. People do it, you know, up until age 90 to 100.
Yeah,
absolutely.
No reason not to. Yeah, absolutely. And and it's also, I'm guessing, a social opportunity.
It
too,
is indeed.
Right?
Very social, and it's a very friendly atmosphere. It's welcoming, and you're not judged by what others are doing. You just do what you can do, and Glenn's a great teacher in that respect and is, you know, very encouraging. And so you always feel a sense of success when you've gone to the class.
Have you taken it?
No.
Oh, are you going to?
I promised my daughter.
I think you've got to take it now.
I've had a lot of good excuses because the classes have been offered while I was working, but I did say, you know, if I'm going to talk about it, I should do it.
I think you should do it. I think that's a
well,
bet.
A few years ago, I did participate in a seated Tai Chi class as an observer that they had at the senior center. So I have taken some of it.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
It's fun. It'll take stress out of your day.
Yes,
I'll
indeed.
Bet. Every day you'll look forward
right.
to that.
Yeah, and we need to find ways to diffuse the stress in our lives because it's there.
What was the saying you were telling me? I walked out of the studio because I had a bit of a frog in my throat.
Oh, yeah. Eat the frog,
you were saying. Eat the frog in the morning.
Right. What that means is that's probably the worst thing that can happen to you during the day. So get the bad stuff over early. And then your day is so much better.
Yes, but, you've already eaten the frog. What? How much worse can your day be?
Ooh, yeah, but when you take Tai Chi, you liberate the frog.
Yes. Very good. I'm sure there's a frog movement in there somewhere.
Probably.
Frog swims across the pond.
Yeah.
So let's talk about if someone's really interested in this,
right.
How can they sign up and how can they make sure they attend?
They can do a couple of things. They can call me at 463-6113. And if I'm not there, just leave a message that you want an application. I can email the applications out. You can email me at Eileen, Eileen.Hosey, Hosey, at ccsjuno.org. Southeast Senior Services is a division of Catholic Community Service.
Is there a website or a place like that where they can find out more, Catholic Community Services?
The Catholic Community Service website does have general information on
it. Okay.
The class starts next Tuesday, February 28th. From 10 to 11 a.m., it's going to be Tuesdays and Fridays for 8 weeks, and it's going to be held at the Greening Park Community Building, just right off the highway. And if you can even show up the first day of class if you want to do it, and Glenn will have some applications there.
Okay.
He doesn't
What's the
know
cost?
That yet. There's no cost.
Oh.
This is free. This is completely free for seniors. Yes.
For seniors, just as 60, a service?
Yep. 60 years and above. Right.
Okay. I know. That's getting closer and closer for me. I'm going to qualify soon.
Oh, yeah?
I'm excited about it.
We'll save you a spot,
yes,
for sure.
That sounds good.
Liberate the frog.
Well, Eileen Hosey, thanks so much for coming in and letting us know about this. Tai Chi for seniors.
Yes.
It's done through Southeast Senior Services. And once again, it's Eileen Hosey at ccs.org.
CCSJuno.
CCSJuno.org.
Right.
So it's Eileen Hosey, and that's Eileen. Hosey, Hosey,
yep.
at ccsjuno.org.
Or you can call me, 463-6113.
463-6113?
Yep, that's correct.
All right.
Yeah.
Eileen, thanks so much for coming in
and letting us
know about this Tai Chi for seniors.
Yeah.
Yes, Tiger salutes the mountain.
We'll see you there soon.
Bird salutes the tree. We're going to go next to Bird Note.
This is Bird Note. The emphatic hoots of a pair of barred owls resonate in the still of a February night. So called for the stripes on their breast, barred owls are among the largest owls in North America. They're also the most vocal, initiating their vocal courtship in winter. Their signature hooting sequence has been memorably described as "Who cooks for you? Who cooks for you all?" But this is just one of more than a dozen barred owl calls, ranging from a siren call to a wail to a wonderfully entertaining monkey call. Although the barred owl's calls have long been heard in eastern forests, it is a relative newcomer to the western U.S. During the 20th century, its breeding range has expanded into the north and the west, and down as far as northern California. The exact reasons behind the expansion aren't certain, but new riparian forests, fire suppression, and the planting of shelter belts in the northern Great Plains are some of the human impacts that have likely played a role. No matter what accounts for the barred owl's dramatic sweep across the continent, the bird and its extraordinary voice seem here to stay.
Science luminaries of Juno is joining me in the studio right now. I'm sure he's embarrassed I said that, but Bob Armstrong is here. Bob, thanks so much for coming in and joining us. You've got a fireside chat series happening tonight, one of the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center lecture series. Tonight, yours is titled Coping with Weather. And this is about not how we cope with weather, although we could all probably use hints there too, but how the natural world copes with weather.
Yeah, most of the what I'm going to present is mostly videos, and there'll be different creatures. A lot of them taken videos taken right near the glacier. Snowshoe hares, mountain goats, water bears.
Wow. So when you talk weather, are you talking about weather events? Are you talking more about seasons or climate, or is it all part of it?
It's variable, whatever appears to be entertaining.
Yeah.
But
so one thing we were just talking about is you said, well, you could do a whole lecture just on insects alone, and that's actually a really fascinating element, what they do to cope with especially winter or different weather conditions. So what are some examples of what do dragonflies do in the winter?
Well, the dragonfly adults pass away before winter, but the larvae continue to hunt and work in the aquatic environment. But what's really fascinating out near the glacier is a little tiny insect called a springtail.
Okay.
And it gets out in winter. It's only 1 to 2 millimeters long, and it goes out in winter to travel across the snow because it gives it a fairly flat surface to spring along on, and it orientates on the horizon.
Really? Okay.
It'll orientate by sun, but sun isn't, so it'll orientate like by the mountains or something. So it can go in a straight line, basically. So it can go from one habitat to another.
And what's it? What's its goal to go to that other habitat?
Just to I'm not sure. I don't. All I know is
we
that they
do
it.
Them. But, and and we're getting at a question I asked you just before we started talking on microphone here, which is that how do this idea of insects, especially even small animals or animals that non-mammal type animals, how do they make decisions? How much is really a part of their brain making a decision, and how much of it is just completely just a natural, it's instinct, there is no decision-making process, they just do what they do?
Well, with insects, I'm sorry, but I don't have much idea of how they go about it. I just finished reading a book on the emotional lives of animals, and he had a short section on insects. And he said that there hasn't been hardly any research done in that area, but he thought that, well, perhaps that they do think from time to time and make decisions. And I've watched a lot of aquatic insects in aquariums and also laid down and watched insects on the soil and stuff. And I hate to admit this, but I'm fairly sure that they have emotions and...
show kind of demonstrate fear of something or demonstrate that they are... I don't know about if we could say happy or sad, but,
But, a lot of people think that, like fish, don't have any emotions. And there's quite a bit of scientific research that's come out in recent years that indicates that they have emotional elements somewhat similar to mammals.
Hmm.
And also that they may, unfortunately, they may experience pain harder than mammals do because they have less ways of coping with it. This was all in this book I was reading, and it was based on research. So,
So the talk that you're doing tonight, what are some of the examples that you're going to be talking about how some creatures cope with weather?
I think mountain goats would be the one that people would be most familiar with, and they're coming down now on the both sides of Nugget Falls. And probably the biggest problems with mountain goats is when we get our rainy periods in winter, and then we get these sudden freezes without any snow, which has been happening a fair amount these last couple years. And what that does is it covers some of their major foods, like lichens and moss, with the glare ice, and they can't get to the food. And so they have nutritional problems in winter, and also it's slipperier.
I was going to ask about their footing. They're so remarkable to watch mountain goats scale what seem like unscalable cliffs. Yeah.
And all the video and I've been doing of them, I notice that they slip quite a bit, even in the non-snowy areas. They're almost every 15 minutes they slip a little bit or something. I've seen the youngsters fall a fair number of feet.
Really take tumbles. Yeah.
But so it's a tough life, particularly in winter, and I think the highest mortality among mountain goats is at that time.
What about bears? Is there any misperceptions about the way bears hibernate?
I don't know.
Okay.
I'm going to cover bears briefly, but the interesting thing is that a friend of mine does a lot of hiking on the flats there near the glacier, and he goes off trail all the time. And one winter, he discovered three different bear dens.
Wow.
And he took me to one of them, and it kind of was scary because the nose was sticking out, and you could see the mist in the air from it breathing, and it was real close to the visitor center.
Really? Wow, I had no idea. Yeah. I just always thought, that's a misperception. I always thought it was up high, that they went up, but there was a lot of kind of guaranteed snow cover.
Right.
They gathered vegetation around them and then let the snow kind of pack in the rest. And but to be down on the flat area where I'm sure there's times when there's not snow cover even.
Like almost now.
Yeah, right. Yeah, fascinating.
And the other, probably the strongest hibernator in Juneau are the marmots. And they go into hibernation quite early. Most of them, the ones that live along the beach and the ones that live in the alpine, both seem to go in early September.
Really? Wow, that seems so early. This seems like the food source would still be available for them.
I think the problem is that the nutritional value of the food source goes down, and so it's better to have a deep sleep than to continue running around eating.
Is there a relationship between them wanting to hibernate and maybe bear activity as well? Is bear activity higher at that point when they're really trying to get fat right before denning? Or I don't know if there's anything like that.
Not that I'm aware of. Yeah. Bears certainly will feed on marmots if they can get to them. Mm-hmm. But
what's a marmot hibernation look like? Are they way down in the earth, or what is it? Is that?
Well, I've never been in looking at them.
Yeah, but, never dug down.
But I've done the literature searching, and the mom has is fairly deep in the soil, or in rocks and such, and the mom and the kids sleep in one chamber that's lined with the grass and such. And the dad sleeps in a different chamber.
Oh, okay.
And then in the whole area, they have what's called a poop chamber. And in the middle of the, you know, while they're hibernating, they occasionally wake up and have to go to the bathroom. So rather than go where they're sleeping, they go to this other place and
go over. Clean little animals.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's very cool. Well, and then what about birds? What are some of the common birds that overwinter in Juneau, and how are their activities changed during winter?
Probably the the most exotic one that's here in winter now is the Anna's hummingbird.
There's hummingbirds overwintering in Juneau.
Yes.
So how do they possibly survive?
I think survival is mostly because people keep their feeders out and heat them up, but they also are very adept at eating insects and spiders. And there's quite a large number of insects, different types of species that come out in winter. And I've noticed that the Anna's hummingbird will be sitting in a brush of alder or something, and it'll suddenly start jabbing all over the place in the bush. And I'll notice there's a bunch of little tiny midge flies.
Interesting. I just maybe foolishly thought that hummingbirds subsisted only on nectar and on the, you know, sugar that people offer. Yeah.
But they need protein.
Yeah.
And that provides them protein.
I see.
But what is really fascinating about the Anna's is there's a wonderful article in a magazine called Birdwatching that talks about why they go north in the fall and all other hummingbirds go the other direction. And the reason appears to be because people were purchasing this eucalyptus tree that blooms in winter. And so throughout the Pacific Northwest, the Anna's hummingbirds learn to go north as winter approached.
So this exotic species of plant changed the behavior of this.
According to this article, it did. Yeah.
Wow, that's really interesting.
But why they come up to Juneau, I have no idea. What
fascinating. And so So that's, as you said, that's exotic and surprising. Well, what about the common ones we see? We see ravens, of course. What are they doing to adjust to weather in winter?
Ravens seem to be extremely adaptable. They seem to love to be out in the rain, love to be in the snow, talk of winds are blowing, and they're up flying around in the air doing their acrobatics, and an absolutely amazing bird.
Yeah, they're tough. Do other birds hide from the rain? Do other birds like actively seek to get out of weather like that?
Yes. A lot of sooty grouse take their young up into the alpine during the summer, and during rainy, windy, cold periods, the mother will raise her wings and all the youngsters come and hide under her. And then as they get older, they're a little bit too large to get under mom, and so she takes them up into, you heard of the mountain hemlock?
Mm-hmm.
Bushes,
mm-hmm.
The ones that we can't walk through.
Yeah, right.
They're really dense underneath and make perfect places for them to take their kids. And I've noticed that quite a bit in the alpine above Juneau. And so there's some value to mountain hemlock.
Right, right. And then there are, it seems, do some ravens and eagles and those birds that we do see around winter, do some of them go south? Or do they all, what's the difference between the population that ends up wintering here and the ones that go south?
The ones that winter here, the advantage of wintering here is you don't have to travel long distances and you don't have to cope with storms and that sort of thing, and you're familiar with an area. And come nesting season, you're already here. And so you can start nesting earlier and such. But a lot of our birds that migrate concentrate on insects. And so they go further south to get that.
Yeah, expending all that energy to
yes.
to actually migrate is a risk.
Oh, yes.
And probably and so... So they're going down during the winter. I'm guessing there's also certain species that are going to breeding grounds and doing that sort of thing as well. But for winter, they're kind of just getting out of the way and coming back up here more typically is what's happening in the flight zones?
A high percent of them come up here to breed.
Yeah.
Because Alaska's a wonderful place for most birds because they often depend on insects, particularly when they're young, and to feed their youngsters and such. And our insect abundance in Alaska is pretty high.
Yes, it is. And the last one I want to ask about is just waterfowl, ducks, and those kinds of things. It seems like there's a population that does overwinter here. And how do they cope with that?
Well, I'm doing a section on the golden eyes, which you see out and about in winter. And what's amazing about them is that in the real storms that we have, the wind storms, you'll see them feeding right next to the rocks in the very heavy surf. And from what I've read is that during those high surf times, a lot of the blue mussels are dislodged from the rocks.
Oh, so they're taking
and
advantage
appears,
of that.
Yeah,
oh,
and the mussels would kind of go around in the... in the surf where the golden eyes could grab it. And,
right.
So that's an interesting adaptation.
The way the natural world is coping with weather, winter weather, and all kinds of weather is the topic of discussion tonight. Bob, you're going to be speaking tonight at the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center. I think is it two different lectures, one at 6:30 and
yes,
one at 8 o'clock. Is that right?
Right.
So
and
doors open at 6, I think, for the first one?
Yes.
And
I've been told to mention that the things that take people up and down.
Oh yeah, yeah,
elevators
right.
Are,
yeah.
are not operating.
I heard they're working on the elevators, right?
Yeah.
So there's a little bit of a stair climb to get there if you're going to get there.
Or there's a ramp
there's
also going up.
Fairly long ramp, but yeah, it'll get you there. But you have to account for that amount of time to get
right.
in via the ramp or the stairs. Well, thanks so much. And the other exciting thing out there is the black wolf, the beautiful black wolf. A presentation that's out there as well, so something to look at in the visitor center as well. Bob Armstrong, thanks so much for coming in and letting us know all about your coping with weather lecture that you're doing tonight. Appreciate
it. Thank you.
I appreciate
the opportunity.
Thank you. worth it for a Juno afternoon for today. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Andy Klein, your host for today. Thanks to Bob Armstrong and all the other guests that came in today. Watch out for that snow. It's supposed to start at about 3 a.m. tonight.
There is no such thing as a global anthem, a global currency, or a global flag.
At a meeting of conservative activists, President Trump strikes a nationalistic tone.
For Friday, February 24th, this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Audie Cornish. This hour, we'll look at how the government might increase the use of social media to vet people coming to the U.S.
It'd be an enormous manpower increase to be checking literally a